We now come to chapters 8 and 9, which are all to do with the matter of the collection. So we go back and remember that when Paul, when he was in Antioch, went down to Jerusalem with some famine relief back in perhaps 45, 46 AD, 10 years prior to the letter we're now reading. And when he was there, he had this conversation with the leaders of the Jerusalem community, including John and James, the brother of the Lord, and Peter, Cephas. And they'd talked it over with him, his policy of welcoming Gentiles, and they approved of it. But they also said to him, look, would you help the poor, meaning the Jerusalem poor? And Paul said he was very happy to do that. So we need to get that in a bit of a setting. See, the problem was that Jerusalem was never really self-supporting. And the Jews, who were in the diaspora, that is, they travelled wherever, to Rome or Alexandria or Cyrene or wherever, Antioch, they used to send money home, as many migrants to this country when they first arrived, send money back to their families who were poorer in the lands that they left. Well, that was common, but you can see what's happening. Once the Christian community forms its own community, gradually, for various reasons, being separated from the Jewish community, they're then very vulnerable, because who's going to help them? Where are they going to get their support from? So the chronic poverty of Jerusalem meant that the community in Jerusalem and around about was very needy, an ongoing need. And so Paul undertook that he would help them. By the way, not by the way, but this is one of the great passions of Paul's life. He had this mission, especially to the Gentiles, and one of the fears was that there would be a split in the community, that the Gentiles would go one way and the Jews would go another. And this wasn't something Paul invented. A lot of the Jewish Christians, as you know, from the Council of Jerusalem, from the trouble Paul had in Galatia, from the trouble of that group that went up to Antioch and accused him and said, you must be circumcising these people and so on. That's a long-standing problem, and it's not all over. So Paul he's afraid the Jewish Christians may be so worried that they may break off or let the Gentile just go its own way, and that the body of Christ would be splintered. Paul would have been dreadfully, or he is, dreadfully hurt by what he sees happening, as Jesus himself is, by the divisions of Christianity now, when we should be loving one another as Christ loved us and presenting the world a loving, welcoming community. And we are doing that, and a lot's going on in that area today, but there's still hurts, historic hurts. And don't let's judge the past too harshly. We've got to work out what we do now. The past, there was a lot of hurt. Families break down even today. Well, if a family breaks down, you know how it can be very hurtful. And sometimes it's hard to resolve family hurts. And the family of Christendom in the West, say, in the 16th century, when it broke down, and it wasn't all on based on religion, it was based on a lot of things. Politics, emerging nationalism, and fault on both sides, of course, on every side, but also goodness on every side. But it did break. And it led to violence and just complete bewilderment and wars and so on. All of that people are still suffering from. And church in Australia, largely founded by the Irish, there's a long history of terrible treatment of the Irish from England. So you can understand these little groups strongly compacting against someone else. Well, with the Vatican Council, thank God, the air breathed in and forgiveness, and people grew up a bit. And there's been a lot of work in the last 40 years from the top of all the traditional Christian communities to respect each other, listen to each other, and try and build bonds of forgiveness and so on. Well, Paul was trying to do that in the first century, of course. And he thought, well, if the Gentiles communities can be persuaded to financially send money to their brothers and sisters who are Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, that'd be a very powerful statement of love, concern, and belonging. So he undertook it. And I'll go take you back to his first letter to the Corinthians, written at least two years prior to this second letter, written from Ephesus, the first one, and they asked him a lot of questions in that. And one of the questions obviously concerned this collection, because in chapter 16, the last chapter of the First Corinthians letter, Paul says, concerning the collection of the saints, saints meaning the Christian Jews in Jerusalem, the founding church. Well, concerning, that's the way he introduces the response to the questions they asked. So, concerning that, he says, you should follow the directions I gave to the churches of Galatia. On the first day of every week, that's the day they come together to assemble as a Christian community, the day of the resurrection, the day of the Eucharist. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put aside and save whatever extra you earn, so that collections needn't be taken when I come. And when I arrive, I will send any whom you approve with letters to take your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, well, they will accompany me. In the meantime, there's been all this problem. There's been accusations about misuse of money and whatever else that we have to read between the lines to get. So now Paul, emboldened by this news from Titus, dares to bring the subject up again, because he's now on his way to Corinth with a view to going to Jerusalem with the money. So he says, chapter 8, verse 1, we want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia. For during a severe ordeal of affliction, they've had very difficult times. We read about some of them when Paul was in Corinth 6 years earlier, when he wrote back his first letter to the Thessalonians and talks about the persecution and suffering. Well, it's obviously still going on. So he says, during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty, they're much poorer than the richer community in Corinth, because Corinth is a pretty wealthy city with all the trade between Italy coming across through Corinth, the Isthmus of Corinth, and then across the Aegean to Ephesus and then the rest of it to Egypt and so on. So it's a hub, a place where a lot of trade comes through it, and that brings wealth, of course. So, but the people in Macedonia are kind of a backwater, comparatively. They're extremely poor. But he says about them, all this has overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For as I can testify, they voluntarily gave according to their means and even beyond their means, begging us earnestly for the privilege of sharing in this ministry to the saints, this diakonia, this divinely willed loving action towards the saints, the Jerusalem community. And this, not merely as we expected, they gave themselves first to the Lord and by the will of God to us. So it's a gift of self, not just a gift of money. A gift of self to God, a gift of self to Paul, and it looks like it was their keenness. Paul may have been losing a bit of heart about this collection, especially with the problems in Corinth. And it was this amazing generosity of these poor little communities that were giving more than they could manage out of their small, meager resources that encouraged Paul to see it as a grace and as something he should do. And it helps him bring the subject up again, and that's what he's doing. So that we might urge Titus that as he has already made a beginning, he should also complete this generous undertaking among you. Titus too may well have seen the possibility of reinstigating this collection. Now, as you exceed in everything, excel in everything, he says to the people in Corinth, as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, and now we need to be clear here, it says here in the New Revised Version, in utmost eagerness. The word eager appears quite a lot in the rest of this chapter. Sometimes it translates prothumia in Greek, which is eagerness. That's pretty direct. Sometimes they use the same translation, eagerness, as in this case, to cover a Greek word, spoude. Now, spoude obviously can be interpreted as a keen eagerness, but it's also used in the literature for something a bit more specialized. It's a certain expertise in business, in know-how, in handling money, spoude. And I think that's what it means in this text. The Corinthians were no mugs. They knew where to put their money and where not to put it. And they were into making money. They're business people on the whole, or slaves of business people. But they're all involved in this turnover of goods and taxes and money. So they pride themselves on knowing what they're doing. And maybe that's what made them a little bit more vulnerable to any accusations that might come to them about Paul's mishandling of money. So I think what he's saying here is this. You excel in everything. Faith, speech, rhetoric, use of words, public speaking, knowledge, gnosis. Remember, the first letter to the Corinthians was all about gnosis, but false gnosis. Gnosis that was not about the crucified Christ, but filling their heads with thoughts because they're used to it, but not really understanding or grasping what it means for God's love to be shown on a cross. Well, he still talks about their knowledge, which they often pride themselves on. Then your complete expertise. And they acknowledge they had that gift. And then he adds, and in our love for you. Beautiful, spontaneous. They got plenty of gifts, and one of the gifts they've got is how much Paul loves them. So, he says, we want you to excel also in this generous undertaking. If one was cynical, one could think of Paul manipulating them by all this, as though it was a kind of flattery to win them over. But please don't go down that track. Paul's genuine with them, for heaven's sake. He means this. And he does want them to excel in this because he wants them to be foremost in convincing and helping the Jerusalem church know how much they're loved by their Gentile brothers and sisters. And he wants to forge the links between the two communities strongly. So he goes on, verse 8. I don't say this as a command. He's not telling them what they should do. He's asking them. Giving them the opportunity, begging them if you like. But he knows it has to be free or it's not a gift. If you don't give yourself, you're not giving anything. I'm testing the genuineness of your love against the earnestness of others. For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ. That though he was rich, for our sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. And in this matter I am giving my advice. It's appropriate for you, who began last year not only to do something, but even to desire to do something, now finish doing it, so that your eagerness and prothumia, yeah, that's eagerness, may be matched by completing it according to your means. For if the eagerness is there, The gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. Again, just a simple, lovely bit of advice. He's not asking them to give what they haven't got. God doesn't ask you to give what you haven't got. He doesn't ask me to give what I haven't got. He asks us to give who we are. The widow in the gospel only had two small coins. That's all she could give. And it's all God wanted. He didn't want her to compare herself to the rich and say, well, I've only got this much to give, it's not worth giving. Of course it's worth giving, it's their gift, her gift. In fact, Jesus said she gave more than the others because she gave all she had. So let's not hide our gifts, and let's not augment them, and let's not compare with others. Just give your love. As a parent, you mightn't feel you've got enough love to give all your kids or all your grandkids, and maybe you haven't. But don't let that stop you. Give the love you've got. No more, no less. Just give it, simply and beautifully. God is the creator, not us. St. Bernard has this beautiful, I think, wise statement about giving, because a lot of us are taught to give, and we might give ourselves right through to to straining. We might so deplete our energies because we feel the need to give, and maybe subtly we want to impress even ourselves by our generosity, I don't know, leaving all that mixed motives and that complicated world aside. But we can deplete ourselves till we've got nothing left to give. We're dead. And not like the cross of Christ, but like the cross of the thief next to him. No, St. Bernard talks about a dam, as it were, and he says, what you should give is the water that spills over the top. God is giving you all his love, all these graces are coming in to fill you with grace. Let it be the overflow that you give to others. The more God gives you, the more flows over, the more you can give. But keep your soul intact. Keep your communion with God intact. Don't leave the source to give everything you've got away. So, I haven't said that too well, but the point I hope is clear. He says, if the eagerness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has. Not according to what one does not have. I don't mean that there should be relief for others and pressure on you. It's a question of a fair balance between your present abundance in money and their need in Jerusalem, so that their abundance may be for your need. He doesn't want them to forget that it was the Jerusalem community that was the beginnings of the Christian faith, and that it's from the Jews, from the Jewish Christians, that all this wonderful gospel spilled out to them in Corinth. They owe them a lot spiritually. Well, let them support them materially. In order that there may be a fair balance, as it is written. To reinforce his point, Paul quotes from a verse in Exodus 16:18, which is actually to do with the manna, but he applies it to this situation. As it is written, he says, the one who had much did not have too much. The one who had little did not have too little. Then he moves on to talk about three people who are going to be coming ahead of Paul to Corinth in order to organize the collection. Thanks be to God, he says, who's put in the heart of Titus the same kind of expertise in money matters as you have. That's a retranslation of the New Revised Standard Version, which says, the same eagerness for you that I myself have. Either way, that I myself have or that you have is not in the Greek. It's added to clarify the meaning. And in the New Revised Standard Version, they assume it means the same eagerness for you, the same eagerness that I have. I suspect having mentioned earlier the meaning of the word spude, if it means the same expertise in money matters, then I think he's actually saying the same that you've got. So you'll understand him. He's a man after your own heart. He understands how to handle money, and you know he does, so you'll trust him with it. Verse 17, he goes on, "For he not only accepted our appeal, but since he's more eager than ever, he's going to you as of his own accord." And he talks about a second person whom he doesn't name. "With him we are sending the brother who is famous among all the churches for his proclaiming the good news. Not only that, he has also been appointed by the churches to travel with us while we are administering this generous undertaking for the glory of the Lord himself and to show our goodwill." So the second person who's accompanying Titus has been appointed not by Paul but by the churches. That's why Paul goes on to say, "We intend that no one should blame us about this generous gift that we are administering, for we intend to do what is right, not only in the Lord's sight, but also in the sight of others." He wants it to appear also to people that Paul himself is not controlling this money and therefore is in no danger of abusing it. Then he adds a third person, "And with them," with Titus and this unnamed person who's renowned among the churches for his ministry of preaching, "and with them we are sending our brother whom we've often tested." So Paul now is adding a third person that he himself is sending, "whom we've often tested and found eager in many matters, but who is now more eager than ever because of his great confidence in you." Who are these two unnamed people? Well, we don't know, and the best we can do is guess. However, you may be interested in looking at Acts chapter 20, verse 4. I'll read Acts 20, 1 to 4. Acts 20 begins with Paul in Ephesus. So this is before he left to come to Macedonia, prior to his writing of this letter. And it says there, "After the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them and saying farewell, he left for Macedonia." Verse 2, "When he had gone through those regions and had given the believers much encouragement, he came to Greece." Greece is the geographical name for the area, including the province of Achaia. So basically he's saying when he came to Corinth. So there's Paul hasn't gone to Corinth yet. Our letter is in the middle of those two verses. The next point is the point I want you to notice. He stayed in Greece for 3 months. In fact, he wrote the letter to the Romans there. That'll be the next letter we'll be studying. He was about to set sail for Syria when a plot was made against him by the Jews, so he decided to return through Macedonia. He was accompanied by, and he gives a list of people who were accompanying Paul through Macedonia to Jerusalem, presumably. They're the ones taking the collection on behalf of the various churches back to Jerusalem. And these are some of the names. The first four are from Macedonia. There's a man called Sopater, son of Pyrrhus from Berea. Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica. And Gaius from Derbe. Oh, that's the Derbe in Macedonia, not the Derbe in Galatia. So there they are. There's four names from Macedonia. It may well be that the two people mentioned here in 2 Corinthians are two of those four. It's only a guess, but it may be a good indication. And now chapter 8 concludes, "As for Titus, he is my partner and co-worker in your service. As for our brothers, That's the other two mentioned. They are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Therefore, openly, before the churches, show them the proof of your love and of our reason for boasting about you.